Today is Tuesday, March 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Some are calling COVID-19 nothing more than a bad cold or flu, but is it?
If this was an influenza epidemic, we would have expected to see widespread community transmission across the globe by now.
Plus, there's already a bump in the road on the way to peace in Afghanistan.
There will be ups and downs, and we'll stop and start.
And another Democrat drops out ahead of Super Tuesday. We'll have all those stories and more next. The World Health Organization is urging countries affected by the coronavirus to enact containment measures as the best way to slow down the spread of this disease. While most of the nearly 89,000 cases of coronavirus are reported from China, the WHO says the virus appears to be declining there while it's accelerating elsewhere. Lisa Schlein starts us off.
Outside China, South Korea is the most seriously affected country. The World Health Organization reports more than half of the more than 8,700 cases of coronavirus reported in countries outside China are in South Korea. WHO cites Italy, Iran, and Japan as other countries of greatest concern. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says COVID-19 is a unique virus with unique features. He says the virus is not influenza. He says it is a respiratory pathogen that is capable of community transmission. At the same time, he notes it can be contained with the right measures.
If this was an influenza epidemic, we would have expected to see widespread community transmission across the globe by now, and efforts to slow it down or contain it would not be feasible. But containment of COVID-19 is feasible and must remain the top priority for all countries.
The executive director of WHO Health Emergencies Program, Michael Ryan, says containment will not get rid of the virus, but the strategy will buy governments precious time in which they can prepare for the possibility of an epidemic of this deadly disease within its borders.
And if we're lucky and if we do the job really well, we may get the opportunity. We just might get the opportunity to interrupt transmission. But at the very minimum, containment is allowing us to significantly slow down the spread of the virus, thereby giving an opportunity for health systems to prepare, for PPE to be made available, for training to take place, for laboratories to get reagents, for laboratory technicians to be trained.
WHO says the earlier countries take action to aggressively identify people who are sickened by coronavirus, the better the outcome. The world body says applying basic public health measures quickly and efficiently will save lives. These measures include finding cases and tracing those who have come in contact with an infected person, managing people throughout the incubation period, and providing adequate care to those in the hospital. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Paris-based Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or the OECD, predicted Monday that the coronavirus will slow global economic growth to its lowest level since the financial crisis. Also, the head of the European Central Bank said Monday that Europe's top monetary authority is ready to take appropriate and targeted measures, if necessary, to support the economy against the headwinds from the coronavirus. But what about the United States, which saw a massive sell-off last week of over 10% on its major exchanges? While markets closed up on Monday, I put that question to Joel Richard Paul at the University of California, Hastings, if last week was a correction or the sign of something to be truly concerned about.
Well, markets tend to overreact to good news and to bad news. And I think that last week's reaction of the market was a bit of an overreaction. Today we've seen something of a correction, which perhaps is another overreaction to the news about the central banks dropping interest rates. I think that the real problem here is a fundamental problem in the disruption in global supply chains and in the demand for travel that may occur as a consequence of the coronavirus. So if we have factories closing down in China or in the European Union, That's going to affect the ability of factories in the United States to produce, and it's going to mean people are going to have more time off, and they're not going to have the same kind of profitability, and it's going to affect wages and so forth. So I think that we do have a serious economic threat potentially here, but I think a correction that has occurred in the market was long overdue, and it's not necessarily the coronavirus may be the precipitating factor, but it may not necessarily be the underlying cause.
You mentioned the impact the coronavirus could have on supply chains and manufacturing and tourism. Given that there's so many unknowns about the COVID-19 and the overall impact it may have moving forward, are there really economic things that governments can do besides saying, hey, we're going to lower interest rates to try and safeguard the economy?
I think that lowering interest rates is a big mistake under these circumstances, because we can't stimulate demand for travel by cutting interest rates. We can't get factories reopened by lowering interest rates. The interest rates are not the cause of the problem in this case, and they will not be the solution to the problem. The risk here is getting ourselves into a liquidity trap, which means that we lower interest rates so much that we can no longer stimulate demand at all. That's the trap that the Japanese economy found itself in for a decade, and that's the trap that we are now at risk of facing. We really have, Steve, I think, the elements of a perfect storm here, because we have a record government deficits, we have the continuing trade wars which have disrupted trade internationally, we have a shortfall in immigration, which has a negative impact on economic growth. We have slower growth in our trading partners in the European Union and in China. And we have seen increasing consumer debt and student debt. And generally, productivity in the United States has leveled off for some time. So we have here all of the elements for a recession.
That was Joel Richard Powell at UC Hastings College of the Law. The Pentagon on Monday laid out plans for the initial withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan while saying it was unlikely that violence in the country would go down to zero even after the United States and Islamist Taliban signed an accord. Now, to get more clarification on whether or not the reduction in violence agreement in Afghanistan would continue, I spoke with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb.
Well, there has definitely been some conflicting messages on what the Taliban is saying and what the Pentagon is saying. A Taliban spokesman said Monday that the reduction in violence agreement has now ended and the Taliban operations would continue as normal. I asked Secretary of Defense Mark Esper about that during our briefing, and here's what he had to say.
Our expectation is that the reduction in violence would continue. It would taper off to we got intra-Afghan negotiations where we'd ultimately consummate in a ceasefire, if you will. So again, day two, we'll deal with issue. We'll make sure we understand attribution, the extent of the attack, and it's going to be a constant engagement. This is going to be a long, windy, bumpy road. There will be ups and downs, and we'll stop and start. That's going to be the nature of this over the next days, weeks, and months. And so I'm not going to get too excited about what happens at the moment. We're just going to deal with each situation as it arises and make sure we stay focused on the mission. The mission here, again, number one, is to make sure Afghanistan never again becomes a safe haven for terrorists to attack this country. We've been very successful for the past 18 years for doing that. And then number two, support our Afghan partners in the process. And then number three, again, as we can, bring our troops home, withdraw our presence in the country. But that's our commitment. That's what we intend to do. And we're going to stay focused on that, because at the end of the day, the best path, if not the only path forward, is through a political agreement between the warring parties.
So as you can hear, the Taliban is saying one thing and the Pentagon's expectations are very, very different.
The other kind of bumpy road situation has been this notion of who is responsible for releasing the insurgents. Did the Pentagon say anything about that?
Well, no, the Pentagon did not have anything to say on the release of prisoners. That is something that would be part of the deal that was negotiated through the State Department. That would not be something that the U.S. military would be able to respond on. But as we are hearing, the Afghan president is not willing to release these prisoners before talks began. It's his understanding that any sort of prisoner release or prisoner swap would happen as a part of this inter-Afghan dialogues. And so the Taliban has said that they do not want to sit down and meet with the Afghan government until any prisoners are released. So there's clearly conflict there as well. So we may be looking at this agreement falling apart before it's really even started to be carried out. But one thing that is happening regardless of this is the United States is reducing its presence. Secretary of Defense Mark Esper said that within 10 days of the signing of the agreement on February 29th that the U.S. would start withdrawing its forces to 8,600. We have said time and again here at VOA that the administration is very for reducing its forces, and that number, 8,600, has been said time and again as a number that the U.S. thinks that it can get down to and still carry out all of the responsibilities that it has with striking terrorists like Al-Qaeda, like the Islamic State, for example, and also training its Afghan partners.
That was VOA's Carla Babb speaking to me from the Pentagon. So, where do things go from here? Now, given the position of the Taliban and the Afghan government, how sustainable is that deal? That's the question I put to Craig Albert, professor at Augusta University.
I don't think it's going to be sustainable for many of those reasons that you've already mentioned. The first one is that prisoner swap. Afghanistan, the government of Afghanistan, said in no way whatsoever would they have agreed to anything like that, and they weren't consulted by the United States going into it. So they have said that that is not a part of the deal, that that would have to take place during inter-Afghan talks. So right off the bat, they say they're not doing that. The Taliban says, well, if you're not doing that, the whole negotiation is off the table, because that's a precondition for inter-Afghan talks for the Taliban. So right there you have probably the largest sticking point or blocking point of the process is this prisoner exchange. The Taliban is asking for 5,000 of 10,000 prisoners that the Afghanistan government has for them. That would mean a huge increase in their ranks if half of their political prisoners were released. The idea that the United States says is that they would agree not to engage in combat, but of course nobody can enforce that. Nobody thinks that that would actually happen if they release those 5,000. By the way, in return for that, the Taliban would release 1,000 Afghan military and personnel officials. But that doesn't look like it's going to happen.
So the other piece of this is that the United States, in its deal with the Taliban, agreed to a troop withdrawal that is conditional. If it pulls back to 8,600 and the Taliban continue to carry out operations, what does that do for the region?
Well, it allows that chaos to continue in the region, and I think that's a likely possibility to happen. The language of the peace deal seems to suggest that the United States may still reduce its forces even if the Taliban continues its violence, as long as that violence is not against coalition or American forces. So that's not strictly what the treaty says, but one can imply from the treaty that there's some gray area within the reduction of violence between the Taliban and the U.S. So if it's directed only against Afghanistan, especially against Afghani government versus civilian forces, that may allow the United States to still reduce its forces. 8,600 is still an ample fighting force for the United States, so that would only reduce it from an estimated 12,000 forces that we have there now to 8,600. So that still gives the United States massive military firepower, especially from drone strikes, special forces operations on the ground. So that's still a deterrent force against the Taliban. So I don't think that is necessarily the largest sticking point of this. It still could create chaos if the United States reduces it further without a commitment from the Taliban to stop violence against civilians and the Afghanistan government. And the Taliban's reading of the treaty is that they can still hurt the government and those loyal to the government as long as they're not attacking outright the U.S.
Secretary Esper said there's going to be some ups, there's going to be some downs, there's going to be some starts, there are going to be some stops. What are you looking at in terms of what needs to happen for it to be a net positive?
There needs to be no violence, massive violence against civilians, which unfortunately has already occurred in the past 24 hours. But that needs to be leveled and decreased as much as possible. And more importantly for the United States' concerns, I think, and for NATO's concerns, is that the Taliban must cease all activities against U.S. forces and coalition forces. That, at least for as far as the United States and NATO are concerned, is an improvement of the security situation on the ground and the security of the national interests of the United States and to all NATO allies. That doesn't do anything for the Afghanistan government, but if the Taliban can be shown to be trustworthy in these confidence-building measures by not attacking U.S. and NATO forces, that gives some leeway and some leverage for the United States to negotiate further and try to pull in the government of Afghanistan into these talks and make more confidence-building measures between those two parties, which are the main antagonists at this point, the Taliban and the Afghanistan government. So we need to work as much as we can for trust-building mechanisms between those two entities right now, and that's the largest blocking point of any real peace happening in the region.
And that was Augusta University professor Craig Albert. And coming up later,
Syrian government forces have recaptured the strategic town of Sarakib on the Damascus to Aleppo highway one day after Turkish fighter jets reportedly shot down two Syrian government Su-24 warplanes.
And you're listening to VOA News.
Hello, everyone. Are you ready to hear the better of the best? Be it from the 80s, 90s, or 2020, some of the retentions are always remembered. You don't want to miss the best covers of all times. Tune in on March 4th to hear the most affectionate retentions of the biggest hits only on Border Crossings, The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. According to exit polls in Israel's third election in a year, embattled Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has made a comeback. His Likud party has won 37 seats in the 120-seat parliament for more than the centrist Blue and White party. With his natural coalition partners, Netanyahu is just one seat short of forming a government. Linda Gradstein has the details.
With high voter turnout, and if the exit polls prove correct as they usually do, Benjamin Netanyahu has made a political comeback. He stands on the threshold of having a majority in the 120-seat Israeli parliament. The dramatic results were announced as polls closed in Israel, giving Netanyahu's Likud party 37 seats and the centrist Blue and White party, headed by former Chief of General Staff Benny Gantz, 33 seats. With his traditional allies of the right-wing and ultra-Orthodox parties, Netanyahu has 60 seats, with the center-left at 54. The results came despite Netanyahu's indictment in three corruption cases, and with his trial set to start in just 2 weeks. Israeli analysts say that if he does form a government, Netanyahu will try to delay the trial indefinitely. Netanyahu loyalist and culture minister Miri Regev said she was thrilled with the exit polls. She said it is a great victory for Netanyahu and a stinging defeat for the Blue and White. At Likud headquarters, party faithful celebrated singing and dancing. At Blue and White headquarters, the mood was somber. Knesset member Yoaz Hendel said he preferred to wait for final results. The most important thing after such a divisive election is to heal the divisions in the electorate, he said. Netanyahu still needs one more seat to get a majority. Final results could give him that seat, or he can convince one member of another party to defect and join him. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar announced on Monday that she was ending her bid for the White House and throwing her support for former President Joe Biden. Now, this is coming the day before 14 states head to the polls to choose delegates for the Democratic Party presidential nomination. This also comes after former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg withdrew his run on Sunday. Buttigieg is also supporting Mr. Biden. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti is in Dallas, Texas, covering the event, and I asked her how the narrowing field is shaping the vote.
You know, we actually were scheduled to cover the Pete Buttigieg rally in downtown Dallas. So we got there early, as we always do, to set up, and I went up to an officer along the fencing, and I said to him, okay, where's the media entrance? And he said, this has been canceled. And everybody around me said, what? So we were all in shock, right? And there were a lot of supporters that simply didn't know what to do with themselves. And they had actually come to Dallas from all over and were anxious to see their candidate who they had either voted for with early voting or they wanted to vote for on Tuesday. So we interviewed a lot of them. One man I spoke to came from New York City to see Pete, and he
said,
I'm traveling
all over
the country.
That's a huge trip, New York to Texas.
It is huge. He said he put his job on hold and decided to give yoga classes everywhere where Pete is. So I said to him, what are you going to do now? And he said, I don't know. He said, but I think I'm going to put my support towards Joe Biden. That's what we're hearing a lot of. A lot of the Pete Buttigieg supporters are now going to Biden. An expert that I spoke with yesterday said this is all in the planning of the Democratic Party. They want to narrow the field of the moderates so that Americans can vote for one moderate instead of one or two, and they're hoping that moderate is former Vice President Joe Biden, and that then it becomes a two-man race between former Vice President Joe Biden and then Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who you know is considered a Democratic Socialist. So his ideas are very different than the moderate Biden.
Right. And then on Monday, Amy Klobuchar announced that she was withdrawing and putting her support behind former Vice President Joe Biden, which really seems to back up what the analysts are saying in terms of trying to narrow the field of the moderate votes.
Exactly. We had heard rumors yesterday that Amy Klobuchar would be the next one to drop out since she was a moderate who had garnered a lot of support. And I think Klobuchar really surprised people. When she came into the race, people were questioning her candidacy, some were laughing at her, and then she proved them all wrong. She said, look how much I can raise, I can go around the country and get support. She showed up for the debates and did a decent job. Now she's throwing her support behind Biden, and she's actually appearing with him here in Dallas, and we will be there at that rally tonight. So Klobuchar has actually got the edge over Buttigieg here. She's already throwing her support behind somebody which she hopes will be the winning nominee from the Democratic Party.
That was VOA's Carolyn Pursuti. Syrian government forces have recaptured the strategic town of Sarakeb on the Damascus to Aleppo highway one day after Turkish fighter jets reportedly shot down two Syrian government Su-24 warplanes. Edward Uranian reports that Damascus is also claiming that it shot down three Turkish drones.
Syrian state TV showed its correspondent standing next to the strategic Damascus to Aleppo highway, which crosses through the center of the town of Sarakeb, as several rockets exploded in the distance. The Syrian army said it had recaptured the town and the highway, which it lost to Turkish-backed rebels last week. Qatari-owned Al Jazeera TV claimed that rebels continue to control the outskirts of Sarakeb and that fighting has not ended. VOA could not independently confirm the claim. Syrian TV reported that Turkish-backed forces keep trying to block the advance of government troops as they attempt to reopen the country's strategic highway grid. A Syrian army officer told Syrian TV that his men were trying to reopen the highway to the coast, which also passes through the same area. He says his men are continuing to push forward despite attacks by Turkish forces and Turkish drones, and that the battle is over reopening the M4 highway from Aleppo to the Syrian coastal city of Latakia. Meanwhile, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan told supporters Monday that Turkey has exacted a heavy toll on Syrian government forces.
Ve değerli arkadaşlar, bu sabah itibariyle şu ana kadar...
He claims that Turkish troops have destroyed 135 regime tanks, 22 armored vehicles, 45 artillery pieces, 44 multi-barrel rocket launchers, 5 air defense systems, 4 mortars, 29 pickup-mounted anti-aircraft batteries, 9 ammunition depot buildings, 2 Syrian government warplanes, and killed 2,557 Syrian soldiers at last count. Erdogan claimed he was receiving numerous phone calls from world leaders, including German Prime Minister Angela Merkel, as well as a visit Monday from Bulgarian Prime Minister Boyko Borisov. Both Russia and Turkey confirmed that Erdogan would meet Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow on Thursday. Arab media reported that the Russian Defense Ministry warned Turkey Monday that it can no longer guarantee the safety of Turkish planes inside Syria due to the closure of Syrian airspace by the government. At least one Turkish drone was shot down near Idlib over the weekend. As thousands of refugees attempted to cross into Greece after the Turkish government transported them to the border over the weekend, Greek government spokesman Stelios Petsas called the influx of migrants at the border an active, serious, severe, and asymmetrical threat to the national security of the country. Arab media broadcast amateur video of a young Syrian man who appeared to have died after reportedly being shot by Greek border police. VOA could not independently confirm the claim. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Authorities in Greece are facing the biggest mass migration push in years, and the government in Athens is laying the blame with Turkey. Greece is beefing up its defenses along its land and sea borders with its neighbor, but the heightened controls are starting to take a deadly toll. Antti Karavassa has that story.
On Monday, Greek government spokesman Stelios Petsas openly accused Turkey of engineering an organized invasion after Ankara opened its borders to allow migrants to pass through to the west. Authorities have already beefed up border controls and repeatedly tear-gassed asylum seekers trying to enter Greece. And on the high seas, the Greek Coast Guard has been pushing back scores of rickety rubber rafts packed with migrants. Turkish authorities have suggested those maneuvers may have caused the drowning of a young Syrian boy on Monday. Greek officials say the child died after the boat in which it was traveling capsized off the island of Lesbos. Authorities tell the Reuters news agency the boat had been escorted to Lesbos by a Turkish vessel. Lesbos residents, meanwhile, staged protests calling on police to block migrants from setting foot on the island. The residents say they are still reeling from an earlier migration crisis, and after seeing their economy shattered and tourism-related business fall by 60%, they want the 25,000 remaining refugees to leave. The island's mayor, Stratos Kitelis, explains. He says if that does not happen, the people of Lesbos will take the situation into their own hands. Nearly 60,000 migrants and refugees illegally crossed to the Greek islands from Turkey last year, roughly double the rate recorded in 2017 and 2018, according to the UN Refugee Agency. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has in the past warned Europe to share the refugee burden or face a new wave of migrants, as Turkey fears a new influx of Syrian refugees fleeing war. Turkey is hosting more than 3.5 million Syrians. Antti Karasava for VOA News, Athens.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Tony Pollack, thank you very much for listening. Now be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy.